Hey, it's Caitlin from C-SPAN. Did you know that C-SPAN has been serving the American people for 45 years? Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners. And now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45. Your contribution helps to ensure that we can continue to provide unfiltered, complete coverage of government proceedings on TV, online, on radio, and our mobile app, as well as context through newsletters, social media, and podcasts. Join us in preserving this legacy of access to the democratic process. Make your tax-deductible donation today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
And that is the opening scene of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, taken at a 1934 Nuremberg rally for Adolf Hitler. Jochen Jack Werfel, when you were 6 years old, you attended a Hitler rally in Berlin. What do you remember about that?
I remember our teachers telling us to be sure to go there and to see Mr. Hitler as he's coming by on his birthday, which is April the 20th. And we did the best we could.
And you and your brother went up to the front, correct? So you could get a good view?
I tried to get up to the front so that we could see him. We were told to do that, yeah.
You were 6 years old at the time. Do you remember how you felt about that?
Well, I felt kind of strange about it because I already knew from my parents that Hitler was not someone we really wanted around or wanted to be with, but our teacher at school encouraged us very strongly to go and try to see him.
Mr. Werfel, in your book, My Two Lives, you talk about joining the Hitler Youth. Why did you do that?
In order to survive. If you didn't, by then I was already in the summer camp up on the North Sea in northern Germany. And if I wouldn't have gone to join the Hitler Youth, my brother and I, people would have said, why aren't these boys doing it? Everybody else is doing it. And we were afraid that they would find out that we were Jewish at that time.
Now, your parents, your father was Catholic and your mother was Jewish. Did that interdenominational faith protect you?
That's correct. My father was Catholic from a very Catholic family. As a matter of fact, he had two sisters who became nuns. He had four other brothers who left before Hitler came into Austria. They were very wise. They went to Spain and from Spain to Cuba and from Cuba eventually to Quito, Ecuador, where they lived for the rest of their lives.
Where were you raised, sir?
Pardon?
Where were you raised? Where were you born?
I was born in Dresden, Germany. My grandparents happened to live in Dresden. Myself and my brother and my parents, we lived in Austria. But when my mother was pregnant with me, she decided to go to her mother's house in Dresden, and I would be born there.
And that was in 1932. What memories do you have of Austria, being raised in Austria, if any?
Well, I certainly don't have any memories from 1932, nor from Dresden at that time. But I do have some memories from living in Gutenstein, which is outside of Vienna in Austria, with my parents, which was a good life. Those were still very nice times for us. That's before Hitler, of course, came into Austria.
What did your father, Karl, do in Austria?
What did he do?
Yes, sir.
He worked for the government. He worked for Mr. Schuschnigg, who was the president of Austria at the time.
And what kind of position did he have?
I don't really know. I just know that he worked for him. He knew it very well. And when Hitler came in, he, Mr. Schuschnigg, and my father were arrested together, put on the same train, and taken to a concentration camp north of Berlin called Sachsenhausen.
Now, your father was Catholic. Why was he arrested and taken? He was described as an incorrigible enemy of the state, you write.
Yeah, he was a political prisoner.
What was his crime, according to the Nazi regime?
Well, because he stayed with the Austrian government, and they were not in favor of becoming part of Germany. And so the Hitler people took all of those people and took them to camps or whatever they did with them, who did not prefer to be part of Germany. And my father, Mr. Schuschnigg, certainly didn't.
You write in your book, My Two Lives, our life in Berlin was calm and stable, but in the 1930s, Jews in Berlin were not entitled to a completely normal way of life. How is it that you moved from Austria to Berlin in 1936?
Yeah, because my grandparents lived there, and they thought I would be safer in Berlin at the time, because it was very strange, but you know, Berlin was one of the later places that was really taken over by Hitler as far as getting rid of Jewish people that they wanted, because they were everywhere in the hospitals, and they were teachers and so on. So the Jews were a big part of the commerce and also the education and so on in Berlin. So there were many other parts of Germany where Hitler took the Jews before Berlin.
Now, you lived with your maternal grandparents, the Baruchs, Ferdinand and Lena Baruch. They were Jewish, correct?
That is correct.
Were you identified as Jewish at that time?
I would have been, yes, because if your mother is Jewish, then you are considered Jewish.
Did you have to wear the yellow star?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Because another thing that my parents did, when they took me to Berlin, they took me to a Catholic church and had me and my brother baptized Catholic. So whenever someone would ask us or we had to complete documents, we were always Catholic on those documents then. And that's what helped us a lot.
Jack, so, go ahead.
Excuse me.
I just wanted to ask if you had memories of Berlin and what it was like in the 1930s.
Yes, I remember very much being with my grandparents. My grandfather and my grandmother were wonderful people, and I loved living with them. My grandfather took me every Sunday. We walked 6-8 blocks to go to the Baltimore Zoo. He took us to have ice cream and things like that. So it was a wonderful life for us, the first time in Berlin, the first couple of years.
What happened to Ferdinand and Lena?
Well, Ferdinand, eventually, all of his partners and all of his family were taken by the Nazis. He knew exactly where they were going and what was going to happen to them. So he took some pills and he killed himself. And I have a death certificate that shows that he died in the Berlin Jewish hospital.
And Lena?
Lena lived for a few more months and then died also. What she did after my grandfather died, I really don't know. But she lived a few more months and then she also died.
Mr. Werfel, as the 30s went on in Berlin, did regulations become more tight? Did you have to be more careful as you went?
I personally didn't, but of course my parents, my mother, my grandparents, they all had to be very, very careful because, you know, the people working for Hitler were becoming stronger and stronger and did more and more of these terrible things that happened in the 30s, especially in the late 30s. After we left Austria and my father was sent to Sachsenhausen, the concentration camp, my mother left and went to Czechoslovakia. And she lived in Prague for a year or two. And she was fairly safe there until Hitler came into Austria. And I mean, into Czechoslovakia and took over Czechoslovakia. And then all the Jews in Czechoslovakia were in the same bad situation. And my mother came back to Germany and came back to Berlin.
Do you remember how she got to Berlin or how she escaped being taken prisoner in Czechoslovakia?
She was not taken prisoner in Czechoslovakia. She came on her own. And I'm not sure, but I was somehow had memories, and my brother seemed to remember it better than I did, that they made somehow arrangements for her to come back on a cold train. A train that was carrying coal, and somehow she got on that train and came back to Berlin.
Jack Werfel, the last time you saw your mother was in 1942 in prison. What is that story? What happened?
Yes. After my mother came back to Berlin, she went to an apartment. And she wanted us to be with her for a while. So we went back to Berlin, my brother and I, and we lived with our mother. And one day, my brother and I were sent on a mission by my mother. She gave us an envelope. And we had to, and she gave us direction what subways to take. And we went on a trip where we had to change subways. And when we got to the destination, we came up the steps from the subway and a gentleman was there. And he gave us his password. And once he gave us the password, we were supposed to give to him the envelope. And we did. And he gave us an envelope. And we took the subway back home. And as we got out of the subway, which was right around the corner from where my mother lived, where we lived with my mother, I saw all kind of Gestapo and SS cars in front of the building. Now, this was a large building. There were many families in there. And my brother and I decided that better than going in and going there with all these SS and Gestapo people, we waited on the corner and watched it from there. And we decided to ask our mother as to why these cars were there and what the Gestapo was doing there once they were to leave. We would go home and ask our mother. Well, after a while, all of a sudden, to our surprise, it was my mother. They were bringing out of the building, put in one of the Gestapo cars, and they took her away.
Do you remember why she was arrested?
She probably was arrested, number one, because she was Jewish, number 10, and number two, because of this these letters that were being exchanged. She was in some kind of communication with my father, who was in Sachsenhausen at the camp, concentration camp, and they somehow had an SS person who helped them to get these letters back and forth. So there was communication all this time between my mother and my father. And of course, when they arrested my mother, they probably already knew about that, I assume.
Was she bribing somebody, do you think, to get these letters to your father in Sachsenhausen?
Yes.
Did you read the letter?
No. What we did after we saw that my mother was taken away and by the Gestapo, my brother and I decided that this letter we were carrying was dangerous. And we went down and back and down into the subway and we tore it into 1,000 pieces and threw it in the garbage can.
How often, Mr. Werfel, in Berlin, did you see the signs of the Gestapo and Nazi signage, et cetera, when you were growing up there?
Did I see what in Berlin?
The Gestapo, like you saw outside your apartment building, and Nazi signage and signs of Nazism.
Yeah, when they arrested my mother, our apartment was locked and they put a big sign up that no civilian was allowed to go back into this apartment at all, that they would be subject to death if anyone would take off the Nazi sign off the door and enter the apartment. And this was done by the Gestapo, of course.
Did you and your brother go into the apartment?
No, not at that time at all. No, my mother told us weeks before, that if anything should ever happen, that she had an attorney, and she gave us his name, Mr. Grossman, and his telephone number. And she said, if anything happens to me, then call this gentleman, and he will make sure that he will have a place for you to live and to make further decisions.
And before we get to that story, I want to ask how you got into the Nazi prison to visit your mother after she was arrested.
Yeah, it took us 3 days to find out which prison they were taking her to, and we found the prison, and my brother and I, we just went there to see our mother. And because we were kids, I guess they just let us go into the prison and no one paid any attention to us at that point. And we saw, as we looked out of the window, we saw a yard below and we saw people walking. And we recognized that one of the people walking in a big circle down below in the outside, that was my mother. And we watched her for a little while, and then they all had to go in. So now the next thing for us was to find out which cell she was in. So we walked through the prison from floor to floor until we found my mother. And there was SS, and there were guards everywhere, but they paid no attention to us at that time. So we found my mother's cell, and she was, of course, very surprised to see us there. And she said, boys, you shouldn't be here. Do me a favor. Be good. I'm going to be I'm not going to come home right now. So you go to school, pay attention to your teachers, and make sure you get a good education. That's the main thing. Now be good and leave the prison, because sooner or later they're going to find you here. They're going to keep you, and you're going to be in the same situation I am in. So leave. And we did. And just before we got to the exit of the prison, an SS guard became suspicious and grabbed us, and we tore ourselves loose. And together we ran out of the prison into the streets. He followed us, but we were a bit faster than he was, and we disappeared in the streets, and we got away from him.
What ended up happening to your mother, Gretel, Mr. Werfel?
My mother's what?
What ended up happening to your mother? Her name was Gretel.
Yeah. Well, my mother was taken to Auschwitz, and she was killed there. So we never saw her again. When we saw for that short moment in the prison, this was the last time we ever saw her and talked to her.
In the subsequent years, were you able to find her gravesite or find out records about her death?
Well, we didn't know for a long time what happened to her. Later on, when we were in this summer camp in northern Germany, the lady who took care of us there, who became like my second mother, she finally told us one day, it was on Christmas Day, a matter of fact, that she had heard that my mother was killed in Auschwitz, and she didn't live anymore.
Jack Werfel, you talked about the lawyer, Mr. Grossman. Did you and your brother Peter call him after your mother told you to?
Yes.
And what did he tell you? What happened?
Well, he found a place for us to sleep, which was near where he lived. And we were only there a few days, 4 or 5 days. And then he put us on a train and we went back to Dangas, which is at summer camp where we had been before. And the summer camp was being run by a wonderful German lady by the name of Irma Franzen Heinrichsdorf, and they took care of us, and she knew we were Jewish. She had two children of her own, and if they would have ever found out that she was taking care of us, she was really endangering herself and her own children, but she took that chance and she took care of us. And we lived with her for many years. I got there when I was 6 years old, the end of my sixth year, and I didn't leave there until I was 17 to come to the United States.
And Jack Werfel, you call her Tanta Irma, Aunt Irma. And
yes.
Here's a quote from your book, from your mother to Tanta Irma. I tell you honestly and openly that I have many doubts whether it is correct to leave the boys an entire year in the country and to let them attend the village school. But then I say to myself, it is much more important to know that my boys are in an atmosphere in which they will continue to grow and they will be kept alive. How did your mother get that letter to Tanta Irma?
Well, my grandfather was really the one who made all the arrangements for us to get to this lady, to get to the summer camp. My grandfather, when he was younger, he was in the German army, and he fought for Germany and France. He was there fighting, and he got the Iron Cross for that, for his heroism in combat. And He was at one time, according to his military pass, which I have, that he was stationed also in Wilhelmshaven, which is only about 6 miles from Dagas. So he knew about the camp, and he knew evidently about Dagas, and that's where he sent us. And he paid for us a certain amount of money to my second mother, so to speak, Tante Irma, and until he died. After he died, she kept us as like her own children, and we stayed there until we were 17 years old.
Mr. Werfel, your father is in Sachsenhausen prison, or prison camp. Your mother is in Auschwitz. Do you think, were you able to talk about this situation with people?
I didn't talk to people about it, but I talked to Tante Irma about it, and I talked to some of my relatives who later on were taken just like everybody else and taken to camps where they were killed. So we really had no one we knew or no one we could really talk to, except I had a wonderful teacher in Dangast in the summer camp. And we would go to school every morning at 8 o'clock, and he would teach us until 1 o'clock. He was an SS officer. Strange as it might sound, but he would teach us, and then at 1 o'clock, we would have to go to work, and our teacher would put on his black SS uniform, get on his motorcycle, and go to wherever. We don't know where he went, where these Nazi parties or meetings were being held.
And that was Edo Peel, correct?
Beg your pardon?
His name was Edo Peel?
Yes, that was my teacher, Edo Piller.
Piller.
P-I-L-L-E, yes.
Did he know that you were Jewish?
Yes, he did. He and my second mother, Tante Irma, they knew each other, and they talked about it. And they both knew, and they saved us.
Why do you think that your teacher, Edo Pilla, did not expose you?
Well, it's a good question. I don't know. You know, he had three boys of his own. He became good friends with them, his sons. His youngest son was my best friend, and then during the war, he was unfortunately killed, which was a terrible loss for me. But we were extremely lucky. Number one, what protected us was the fact that we were baptized Catholic. Number two, that we were in Dagas with Tante Irma, who protected us. And number three, she had two children, a daughter and a son, and they were both in the Hitler Youth. And she told us as soon as we got there that we should be also in the Hitler Youth, that if you would not be, people would question, what are these children doing? Why aren't they in the Hitler Youth? So in order to be safe for all of us, you two better join the Hitler Youth, which we did.
We're going to show a little bit of video of the Hitler Youth here and get your reaction.
By 1936, there were 5 million to shout their adoration for the Führer. At every rally, they sang their hymn.
Also dieses Hitler-Junglied, das ging so. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Veteranen Fanfaren. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Jugend kennt keine Gefahren.
Wenn wir marschiert sind, haben wir immer gesungen. Und es war nie wichtig, dass wir richtig und gut gesungen haben, sondern immer, dass es laut war.
Jochen Jack Werfel, does that song sound familiar to you now?
Well, the German sounds familiar to me. I don't know exactly what you said there, what it was meant. But as far as singing is concerned, we had to sing Nazi songs every morning when we got at school. That's the first thing we had to do. And the songs were like, "Es steht an der Nordsee, die Eiserne Schar," which means here we are in the North Sea and we are a group of people who are aware and will fight the danger of the youth, of the Jews. And songs like this, there were several songs like this, we had to sing every day. And Peter and I sang those songs with the rest of the children in the school. This was a very small country school. We only had two classrooms. One room was for the age, for grade 1 to 4, and the other one was for 5 to 8. And that was usually the end of the education in Germany at that time.
Do you remember when the war started?
Yeah. That was in 1938 when the Germans invaded Poland. 1939. And I mean, that's all we heard on the radio. It's constantly the propaganda from the Germans and how the war was going, that they were doing a blitzkrieg, which I don't know if you know the word, but blitzkrieg means a very fast war, as fast as lightning. And this is what the Germans did with all their airplanes and tanks, and they had an amazing army and amazing weapons at that time.
And so listening to the radio, to German radio, you write in My Two Lives about listening to this man on the radio. We're going to play a little bit of audio.
Das Judentum erweist sich hier wieder einmal als die Inkarnation des Bösen, als plastischer Dämon des Verfalls und als Träger eines internationalen kulturzerstörerischen Chaos. Wir sehen im Judentum für jedes Land eine unmittelbare Gefahr gegeben. Wie andere Völker sich gegen diese Gefahr zur Wehr setzen, das ist uns gleichgültig. Wie wir uns aber dagegen zur Wehr setzen, das ist unsere Sache, in die wir keinerlei Einfluss dulden.
Jack Werfel, do you know who that is?
Yeah, this is the propaganda minister, Mr. Goebbels.
What do you remember about listening to him on the radio?
Well, we constantly listened to him. We had to. We had no choice. Even in school, in class. If he gave an important speech, then we all had to listen to that.
During the war, were you able, first of all, was there an air of suspicion during the war that you might be outed as Jews?
Yes, there was suspicion, and some people from the SS and Gestapo came to see Tante Irma several times to ask her about us, but somehow she was so clever, she always talked her way out of it and got rid of them to leave and leave us alone. But this happened several times. But she simply said that she adopted us and we were her children, and it worked. We were very, very lucky, very, very lucky.
One of the things you write about in My Two Lives is that your father escaped from Sachsenhausen twice to come visit you.
Yes, he did.
How did that happen?
Well, I don't know exactly how the escape happened, but he came to Dungas to see us, and he brought my mother at that time. This was right after she came back from Czechoslovakia, before she was arrested, before we lived with her in Dungas, in Berlin.
Did he get in trouble for that?
Yes, he did.
What happened?
Well, the second time, I think in my book is are the notes from the commander of Sachsenhausen, of the concentration camp, who personally sentenced my father to be a Schuhläufer. That means to run in shoes. And they had a big circle in front of the concentration camp. And the Schuhläufer had to wear shoes that were about 3 or 4 sizes too small for them. And they had to carry a big bag of rocks on their back, in a bag. And they continuously had to run in this large circle until they died. And that sometimes took a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And my father was sentenced to that. How he got out of that, I never know. But he did not die there. He got out of it. And eventually he was taken to Mauthausen, which is a concentration camp in southern Germany, right near Austria, right where his home was, in Linz. And he was in a concentration camp there, which was worse than Sachsenhausen.
Did he die in the concentration camp as well?
No, he did not. He was freed in 1945 by the American army. They freed everybody in Mauthausen. And he was taken to a place, people who took care of him and were trying to get him healthy again, because he only weighed a fraction of his weight that he originally weighed. He was very, very skinny, nothing but bones. And what happened to him was both of his lungs were totally gone and were sick. So he lived with this farm family after he came out of the concentration camp after the war. He lived there for about 2 months, and they tried to bring him back to life, back to health, but they didn't. He eventually died there. And I went there later, and I met the people, and I talked to them, and I talked to the doctors who treated him, and so on. And then I looked for his grave, but I never found his grave, because there were so many people who were dead when the army came in, and people that died right after. So they were probably all buried in a mass grave somewhere. And we have no idea where he was buried.
Jack Werfel, during your time with Tante Irma in northern Germany, did she give you warnings on a regular basis about how to behave?
Well, I think Peter and I, we knew what to do. We were very, very careful. We talked to her about that sometimes, what we did and how careful we were, and that we would go along with everything that we had to do in school. And she knew what we had to do, and we talked about it. And we told her how we disliked it, but we had to do it in order to stay alive. It was either that or we would also be taken somewhere and killed. And my brother and I decided we'll do anything we have to do in the Hitler Youth to stay alive, and we did.
In fact, your daughter found a picture of you in Time magazine as a Hitler Youth, didn't she?
Yeah, I was 6 years old. I was in first grade in Berlin, and I made some pictures of it. I'd like to show it to you later on.
And how did she find this picture?
You know, it's amazing what happened there. This was the year 2000. The war was over, long, long over, as we all know. And in the year 2000, my daughter Lisa decided, or tried to decide, what she was going to give her father for Christmas. And she went to a bookstore, and she saw this book from Time, which showed all the important things in pictures that happened in the century 2000. So she bought the book because she thought, oh, my dad likes history. He would probably enjoy that and see what happened in this century that he lived in, what else happened, or he probably knows a lot of it. And she gave it to me for Christmas. I had it, and it took me 2 or 3 days. One evening, I took the book when I was going to bed, and I decided to look at it, and I see all these pictures about President Nixon and famous movie stars and Marilyn Monroe and on and on and on. And all of a sudden, I come to a page, and I look, and that's my first class. That's all my friends, the kids that I started school with. And what happened, we had just come out of class. And when we came out of class, in the back of the school, we always had to march, learn how to march, stand in formation, raise our right arms and say, Heil Hitler. And so they were teaching us then, when we were 6 years old, to be in the Hitler Youth already. This already was the Hitler Youth. It was like, that's all we got is, you know, their philosophy, Hitler's philosophy. And yeah, that was in this book. And it's an amazing, amazing thing. I don't think it would happen in a million times again, that my daughter would go to a bookstore to find a present for her father. She buys a book that she thinks he would like. She gives it to me. And there's a picture of me in there. And this is 80 some years later that the picture was taken. Just amazing.
During the war, were you able to get information besides propaganda from German radio?
Yes, we did. We got information from the British Broadcasting Company. We would turn that on occasionally at night and listen to what was really truly happening in the war.
Was it dangerous to listen to the BBC?
Yeah, if you got caught, yeah. You're not supposed to do that, of course. But we did. You know, I can tell you an amazing story about that. I remember so well when I watched BBC, and here I finally see the Americans landed D-Day in Normandy, and they got a foothold, and they were on the beach, and they finally got inland. And this was D-Day. We were so happy because we felt now the Americans are coming. They're finally, the war is probably going to come to an end. and there won't be any Hitler anymore. Well, how old was I then? You know, it was like...
You were 12.
Yeah, I was 12 years old at that time. Do you know later on when I came to the United States and I was drafted into the United States Army, 3 years after I was in the States, I was drafted. And I was sent to Germany rather than Korea. It was during the Korean War because I spoke German and they needed interpreters to train the German army, which they were training, the Americans, they were training then, the German army again. And here I was in the army, and one day my company commander sent someone out and said I was supposed to report to him. And I did. And I reported to the company commander, and he said, look, I watched you several times when you walked from your billets over to your office where you work. And you have very good posture. You walk very straight. And I would like for you, if you would, if you can, to be in the Division Color Guard. This is the 1st Infantry Division, 20,000 men. And I was, they were asking me to carry their flag at all the parades and whatever. Well, it so happened that one day they told me that I was going to Normandy. Why was I going to Normandy? To take the colors to Normandy for the 10-year anniversary of D-Day. And I went, and it was the most amazing experience for me. Amazing to be in Omaha Beach and to walk all these places where we lost so many people, but where the Americans finally succeeded and got finally into Germany. And it was amazing. And I'll never forget that one morning, they asked the color guard to come out, and we went to President Roosevelt's grave. Roosevelt had several sons. One of his sons was a general, and he was killed there at Omaha Beach. And he was buried there, and his grave was up there. And we went there, and just the color guard and a bugler to bugle, to play his trumpet. And the sun was rising over the British Channel, and we looked out over the British Channels and dipped the flags in honor of General Roosevelt. And the bugler was playing. It was an unbelievable experience for me. And I was so proud to be in the American Army. So proud. And that I was able to be at that beach those few years later, after I heard it on the British Broadcasting Company, that D-Day had taken place.
Jack Werfel, when you were in the U.S. Army and back in Germany, you went to visit Tante Irma and your old teacher, the SS officer, Edo Pilla. What was that like?
Well, I did visit Tante Irma, of course, and spend time with her. I went there 2 or 3 times while I was in the Army. But my teacher, he was, because he was SS, he was in prison or whatever. I mean, I don't know, but there was a prison, you know. I think at this time it was a Canadian and the Canadian Army who had taken him prisoner as an SS officer, and he was still a prisoner at that time, and we didn't even know where he was. But later on, Tante Irma found out where the prison was, and she went there and told them what Herr Pilla did and the type of person he was, and that he saved us, that he knew we were Jewish. And he got out of the prison on account of that. So that made us feel very good. But I didn't see Herr Pille again until many, many years later when I went there for a visit and I took my two children, Dana and Lisa, and went to Germany to show them the camp, to show them what Tante Irma at her house and where we lived during the war and what we did during the war. And we went to visit Herr Pille, and he lived in a very nice little apartment in a nice part of the city of Faro, which was about 8 miles from Bangust, where Tante Irma was. And we visited him, and he was just 91 or 92 at that time. And when he opened the door and saw me, his tears were rolling down his cheeks. He was so happy to see us and to see me with my children and that I was alive and doing well. And that was also a very special moment in my life, of course, you know.
What was your life like in the United States?
Pardon?
What was your life like in the U.S. in the subsequent years?
Oh, my life in the United States? Oh, Peter, when I got to the United States, I was the happiest person in the world. You know, I didn't know anybody. I had no money, but I was in the United States, a country where there was freedom and democracy, and where people could do what they wanted to do. And coming out of Hitler's country and suddenly being in the United States, it was unbelievable. I was the happiest kid. I was only 17, but God, I remember I was so happy. And it was so amazing just to see, I came to New York, to see the skyscrapers, to see millions of cars everywhere. And it was just amazing. And as soon as I, you know, got to the United States, the first thing I needed to do was to learn the language. Actually, I was in New York for about 6 months before I came to Dungast, waiting for my papers, which the American Army said, we'll get you your papers. You just go to, you know, we have made arrangements for you to fly to New York. So we did with the United States Committee for Care of European Children, which was financed by the Catholics and the Jewish people. And actually the Catholic Committee paid for my brother and for myself. And this is how we came to New York.
Jack Werfel, it's 2024. You were born in 1932. Why did you wait so long to write this book?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you know, I can't tell you how many times people had asked me, Jack, they called me Jack here. I gave myself the name Jack because no one could pronounce your. So they said, Jack, why don't you write a book about your life? That's interesting. And the little bit they knew about it, they thought it was just fantastic. To me, it was just my life. It wasn't that special because I knew there were thousands of people who had similar lives as I did in Germany. And then hopefully some of them got out the way I did and went to other countries. And I kept saying, let someone else write the book. I'm not a writer. And I don't know how many people asked me to do that. And then 2.5 years ago, my daughter, Dana, who's sitting here next to me because she helps me with the computers. Dana and her husband, Tom, sat me down and said, Jack, you got to write a book about your life. This is for the family. Someday we have to know and our grandchildren and their children and their children and their children got to know what happened to our family, how did we come to the United States, where we were from, and so on and so on. And there's one person in the world I can't say no to, and that's my daughter, Dana. We have a very special relationship, and I just couldn't say no, and I finally said, okay, I'll try it. I'll write the book. So I did. It took me about two years to finish it, and it happened to be published about exactly the same time as Hamas and Israel got into this war, this terrible war, you know, where Hamas killed 1,700 Jews and killed the children in front of their parents and the parents in front of the children and the horrible things they did. And
Mr. Werfel, do you identify as Jewish or Catholic today?
You know, my family, I finally, you know, eventually, you probably got this in the book, I got married to
Zonia,
a girl from El Salvador, and she was very Catholic. And she wanted to make sure that her children would be raised Catholic. So I had to go and sit with a Catholic priest for about 10 hours, 10 different times, before they permitted for us to get married in a Catholic church. We couldn't get into the, really the inside of the where the priests do their things for mass and so on. So we were married right outside of that, but inside the church. So I was married Catholic, and I kind of had to promise that my children would be raised Catholic because my wife's, these were my wife's wishes and so on. So my children were raised Catholic. How I felt about it, well, I learned a little bit about the Catholic religion, and I would go to church. I would go to church with my children and their children on special holidays, and I would go to the Catholic church. But as far as the Jewish part of my family is concerned, I was never raised Jewish. Although I have many Jewish friends here in Baltimore who are very, very good friends. And a matter of fact, one friend who's my accountant, Simpson Garden, we went twice to Israel together. And I was amazed what a beautiful, wonderful country Israel was. And I was very happy to see that. That was probably one of the most important trips I ever took. And I took many trips in my days while I was in business, in the insurance business. So.
Well, let's leave it there. Jochen Jack Werfel, My Two Lives is the name of the book. We appreciate your spending an hour with us here on C-SPAN.
Is it an hour already?
All Q&A programs are available on our website or as a podcast on our C-SPAN Now app.